I'll repeat a little bit of what I wrote today. Reflecting on the war in Gaza in this moment, but this war really as, you know, as the new eruption of an old war, at least, you know, as old as I don't even want to say how old, you know. The Palestinians have been resisting Israeli occupation for many decades. Israel has been planting roots in this land for many decades, expanding its presence in the land for many decades. There have been many different peoples and empires that have ruled the land currently called Israel and Palestine. And there are many different peoples whose deep ancient ancestors walked that land and prayed on that land and shared the holy city of Jerusalem. And it is one of the most, perhaps we say holy because so many people think of it as such, pieces of land on the planet. I'm personally not sure what makes any piece of land more holy than any other piece. I think it's all holy, if you want to use the word. But because humans partly create what's holy by the turning of their attention towards something, we can know that this place has been called holy by so many and is held in so many hearts sincerely, and is also held in so many hearts and minds with fear and hatred and contention. And so everyone in this fight is wounded in so many ways, right? We know the historical wounding, the ancient oppression of the Jewish peoples. We know the historical wounding and the oppression of the Palestinian peoples. But I think that to reflect on how to be with war is, from a Dharma perspective, is not about just laying on the table the various oppressions and historical injustices and saying, see, everyone's wounded. That's true, but I think it's a little facile, so I want to try something else here. And that is that we can see that humans, and I'll speak specifically to humans here. I see animals do things that seem unwise and destructive of ecosystems when ecosystems become unbalanced. But I don't know what war or genocide means to a wolf or a pine beetle or an out of control algae bloom. So I'm just going to stick with humans here. We have the feelings and words to talk about what we're doing. So this is us. Humans, for a very long time, seem to have entered into conflicts with other humans that have been tremendously violent and destructive of life. Why we do this? I can repeat explanations from ancient texts, but actually my heart doesn't quite understand. My heart knows what it feels like to be afraid and what it feels like to feel like I have to protect what's mine or to protect that which I care about. So I get those feelings. And I know what it feels like to feel like I might have to be violent to protect those things. I've been privileged enough to not be in a position where I have felt forced to become violent. And that's a tremendous gift of safety in the world. But this is clearly something humans do. And when large-scale violence erupts, but maybe even when small-scale violence, one person killing another person, harming another person, it never ends there. One violent crime against one person out of anger or greed or fear or hatred, is a fractal of, the violent crime of a nation state against another nation state, a government against another government, because it's never complete. So the insight or the teaching I want to start with is that there's no such thing as victory. That the thing that violence wants, ostensibly, if we take it seriously and its intentions seriously with sincerity, we might say violence wants to restore peace. It wants to create a situation where there's safety and ease, where families can live in peace with their children, where people can worship and play and make art and pray. But we humans so easily identify first with our families and our tribal selves, the people that are like us, however you define that now. And there's various rings of belonging we can identify with that we might call tribal. But so often that identity, that self, that selfing as a member of a group, takes over the story of wanting peace, of wanting security, and it becomes wanting peace and security for those who are like me. Everyone on any side of a war, what they want is the end of the war and the return to peace. No one wants to be at war, except a few truly psychotic, may they be well. Mostly everyone wants the war to end, but on my terms. I want safety for my people. I want safety for the ones I care for, the ones I love, the ones I trust, the ones I want to be with and feel belonging with. And so a first recognition coming from the teachings of the Buddha on who we really are is that that belonging is fragile, thin, not inevitable, not possessing of a kind of finality of identity. And there's all of these texts where the Buddha is in having conversations usually with Brahmins about what it means to be a Brahmin rather than a warrior, aristocrat, or a worker, or a merchant, the four kind of primary castes in ancient and modern India, Southeast Asia. And in one of them, a Brahmin student comes to the Buddha and says, do you really know what a Brahmin is? And the Buddha says, do you really know what a Brahmin is? Let me ask you some questions. And the kid is a little cocky, so the Buddha, thumps him up and down the mat, as they say in the suttas. But the conversation is revealing because the Buddha says, okay, tell me what a Brahmin is. And the Brahmin student says, a Brahmin is one that is well born on his father's and mother's side and has memorized all of the Vedas and has done all the learning and learned all the chants and that and that. And the Buddha says, all right. And first goes through all the marriages and says, well, if a Brahmin, marries a Kshatriya, is the child a Brahmin? Depending on the genders, flips them back and forth, yes, it is, no, it isn't, go through all the options. And then the Buddha starts giving different examples. And what it really works down to is the Buddha corners the student into admitting that if you have, a well-born Brahmin on both their parents' side who's learned all the things, but is unethical, so behaves in a way that causes harm, and you have a well-born Brahmin on both sides who learns all the Vedas, but doesn't cause harm, keeps the precepts, which one is truly a Brahmin? And the student has to say, well, the ethical one is truly the Brahmin. And the Buddha says, there you go. This is why I say that being a Brahmin or that nobility comes from actions, not from birth. And this thesis runs throughout the discourses of the Buddha, that the conditions of your birth depend on past karma and various conditions in the world. They're not determinative of your quality or your worth, but more than that, they're not really determinative of who you really are. And that who you really are, in a way, and we'll put that in big quotation marks given selflessness, that who you really are, and which really means like your path in the world and your fundamental well-being, the possibilities for your own happiness and satisfaction, it depends on your actions. So everything hinges on actions. And that means that it doesn't hinge on identity. So, the important part about who I am is what I do and what I say and how I care for the people around me, not whether I am this or that ancestry, this or that identity, this or that tribe of any kind. This teaching is a difficult teaching for this particular war, because at the heart of the conflict are ideas on all sides that the parties to the conflict, which we might oversimplify to say Jews and Arabs or Jews and Palestinians, which is actually a gross oversimplification, because the parties to the conflict are actually the right-wing Netanyahu government and the relatively corrupt Hamas extremist government, both of which desire the annihilation of each other. It's not really about the Jewish people or the Palestinian people. This seems clear, relatively. But in the generalization and the way that it's difficult to talk about this current conflict, one of the reasons it's difficult is because talking about the conflict too easily slides into trying to say something about people's tribal identity. And that's always going to be wrong in a certain way. It's never going to be possible to say Jews are always like this, Arabs are like this. It's just not that way. And it's not what constitutes goodness. There's no way to say, Jews are the good people, therefore I'm on their side, and I wish they were not, I wish they were safe from harm. Of course, I wish they were safe from harm. It's also, not possible to say Jews are the evil people, I wish the Palestinians were safe from harm. Of course, I wish they were safe from harm. But it's people's actions that make who they are. And so the teaching on selflessness or not self, and the teaching on the primacy of action, this is the teaching on karma, has the power, I think, to really shift how we relate to a conflict like this, that at least in part is very tribal, is very these people, those people. And we can just feel the pain of that. There's no such thing as victory in war. So anytime there is even the fullest victory you could perhaps imagine, there's a terrible shadow. When I was first learning about the history of North America and the European conquest of North America, the book on the history of Native America that I read spent a good long time talking about the so-called Indian Wars, the wars of the British colonies and later American colonies in the 19th century against the big warrior tribes, the Sioux and the Apache and the Blackfeet and the Cherokee and the Crow and the Choctaw and the Five Nations and the groups that fought back, the groups that really, created big strokes in the history book. It's like, oh, chapters upon chapters of those. And I remember getting to the chapter on California in this particular book, and there are better books on the history of Native California, but in this one, the thesis of the very short kind of mini chapter on everything west of the Sierras was the native people of California were peaceful and non-warlike. Because of that, they were captured and killed almost immediately with relatively little resistance, and there are none of them left. Now, none of that was true. There was lots of resistance. They were not captured quickly or easily, and there are lots of them left. So, you know, correct that story. But we might say that, you know, compared to, let's say, the Diné of Arizona, whose reservation takes up, you know, like a fifth of the state, and is a huge nation within our nation, you know, compared to that, the, you know, the Southern Pomo and Miwok peoples of the land that I'm teaching on right now have, you know, a couple tiny plots of land and a couple tiny communities and, you know, far less resources, you know, and stature, and far less population left. And so, you know, would we say in a kind of terrible way that the victory of the Spanish really, because this was all Mexico when it happened, that the victory of the Spanish over the native Californians was a complete victory? You know, now I'm living here. My ancestors were Spanish and English, so I come from both sides of the colonial force, or both big wings of the colonial force here in North America. You know, now I'm here, and I know some of the Coast Miwok, and I've been to the Pomo dances here, and I've heard their prayers, and I've heard them say, you know, here we are, like in 2023, you know, 250 years after the devastation began to come upon our peoples, and we are still here dancing these dances, reconstructing them. I was at a Pomo dance out on the coast near Bodega recently, and this one group said, we lost our dances in this century, in all of the displacement, and we thought they were lost for good, but then someone came, one of our friends from a tribe further north, and they had known somebody, and they had known somebody, and they had known somebody, and they took a dance that had been shared around the coast, and they gave it back to us. And here it is, we're going to do it for the first time. And, you know, like whatever the victory was against these peoples, the shadow of that victory is long. And every time we say a land acknowledgement now, we are bowing to and sitting in and feeling the cold breeze of that shadow in this land. And there's no land on earth that doesn't remember those who lost the war, those who once lived there or who once, you know, loved there, who lost. So there's no victory that gives rise to the peace that any party in war wants, right? Victory only gives rise to a further, you know, a more extreme imbalance in positions. You know, the Pomo here have so little power compared to the United States government, the California government. So, but that's the most that victory, you know, could get. Is a future where now there's a suffering, traumatized, oppressed class of people trying to find their way. And so what could possibly come of this war? What is the possible outcome? There's no good end that I can see. You know, folks who wanted a two-state solution for the last 50 years, what would that look? What would even that, the best hope that anyone ever suggested, what would that look like, you know? And so recognizing this, I think the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha point to, we've already looked at how they point to not self and how that undercuts tribalism and the kind of us and them binaries that come when we get over-identified with one group of people and we forget the humanity of another group. Right, but along with not self in the characteristics, right, is dukkha, is fundamental dissatisfaction and suffering. If you can't bear how things are, you will lash out in the world. Right? Craving is not just the personal anguish of wanting a partner that I can't be with, or a dessert that I think I shouldn't have, or whatever trite examples Dharma teachers give. Craving is, you know, my people don't feel safe in the world and we must have this land. You know, craving is I need the world to be the way I want it to be. You know, I've lived here for centuries. I want to keep living here. We don't get that. No one gets that forever. And so dukkha is fundamental here, and it's obscured when we take sides. Because when we take sides, we really end up feeling like I get to be satisfied in the knowing that I know who's right, you know, and what should happen. Dukkha always knows what should happen, right? I always should be able to have the dessert I want and the lover I want and the land I want and the safety for my family and my people that I want, you know? But all of this is craving. Craving isn't evil. It's not wrong to want to crave safety for the people I love and well-being and rootedness on the land and justice. But it's craving, and it's gonna hurt. And it never doesn't hurt. That's the first noble truth. Craving never doesn't hurt. So we have dukkha, we have anatta, selflessness, and we have impermanence, you know, anatta, the characteristic of change that, you know, victory is never permanent, loss is in a certain way also never permanent. There's extinction, but again, selflessness. I'm not going to touch extinction very much. Extinction is mysterious, to be a whole species that then disappears. But again, you know, remember rebirth. We don't actually know what it means to even be a human, right? To even over-identify as a human, our ultimate tribe, right? The humans, what does that mean? You know, the Buddha's like, well, in that lifetime, I was a wise rabbit. And I'm like, that makes sense to me as much as anything else, you know? So I'm not even sure what it means, you know, to go extinct, for a species to go extinct. And we all were dinosaurs, you know, don't know, I don't know. But if selflessness is a helpful way of describing the world, then rebirth and interdependence also are, because they're all the versions of the same teaching. So impermanence then is that there's no permanent victory, there's no permanent defeat. But that also means that there's no peace. That peace based in conditions, this is really where the Buddha goes, I believe, right? This is Third Noble Truth. That peace based in external conditions is temporary at best and myopic. You know, peace for me probably means despair for someone else, right? Comfort for me right now with the amount of resources that I use and the privileges that I have and where I sit in the global capitalist system means despair for others. So there's no peace. If you can open your lens wide enough, there's no victory, there's no peace, there's no identity, there's no security. Right? All of those things are temporary fictions. And they're not wrong, right? They're not even unhealthy. The nervous system needs to feel security and belonging and attachment and home in order to be well, and actually in order to be able to practice the Dharma toward liberation. You have to be well enough and protected enough to be able to dismantle the last vestiges of delusion in the heart. So we need that. But it's going to eventually be uprooted if we practice wholeheartedly and successfully. So I'll roll toward pausing there. Give us some time to be in discussion together. I'm using this framework of the three characteristics: dukkha, unsatisfactoriness or suffering; anicca, impermanence or change, flux; and anatta, not self, selflessness, which unfolds into interdependence, emptiness. The teachings on karma and rebirth are all folded in there. These characteristics then are present in this conflict, of course, but in particularly in our own hearts, in how we witness or hold or try to support those who are suffering in a moment like this. And I think it's difficult, but it suggests toward us, it suggests for us, the practice in the Dharma, the practice of the taking the lens of the Dharma, to resist taking sides in an overt, like tribal kind of way, without falling into detachment. Like, remember, like this is people suffering, and so you hold compassion, to hold presence, to hold witness. This is very difficult to do in this moment. Like everything in our culture wants you to take a side and is going to judge you for it. I think this is one of those moments where the Buddha says this is the path that goes against the stream, goes against the stream of how people think about the world. But to not get caught in a thicket of views, in a tangle of views, is to maintain a kind of clarity in the world that is hard to come by. So see the characteristics in our own hearts. Let that support us in how we view and hold and care for and love and meet with wise words as best we can, with wise actions as best we can, those around us who are suffering, and figure out how to take action in a way that has a chance of being helpful. All right, so pause there. Thank you for listening and reflecting, just being in the practice together of this.